Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality. Written by Eliezer Yudkowsky. Narrated by Jack Farrases. Chapter 1. A Day of Very Low Probability. Beneath the moonlight glints a tiny fragment of silver. A fraction of a line. Black robes falling. Blood spills out in liters, and someone screams a word. Every inch of wall space is covered by a bookcase. Each bookcase has six shelves going almost to the ceiling. Some bookshelves are stacked to the brim with hardback books. Science, maths, history, and everything else. Other shelves have two layers of paperback science fiction, with the back layer of books propped up on old tissue boxes or lengths of wood, so that you can see the back layers of books above the books in front. And it still isn't enough. Books are overflowing onto the tables and the sofas and making little heaps under the windows. This is the living room of the house occupied by the eminent Professor Michael Verus Evans and his wife, Mrs. Petunia Evans Verus, and their adopted son, Harry James Potter Evans Verus. There is a letter lying on the living room table, and an unstamped envelope of yellowish parchment addressed to Mr. H. Potter in emerald green ink. The professor and his wife are speaking sharply at each other, but they're not shouting. The professor considers shouting to be uncivilized.
"You're joking," Michael said to Petunia.
His tone indicated that he was very much afraid that she was serious.
"My sister was a witch,"
Petunia repeated. She looked frightened, but stood her ground.
"Her husband was a wizard."
"This is absurd," Michael said sharply. "They were at our wedding. They visited for Christmas."
"I told them you weren't to know,"
Petunia whispered.
"But it's true. I've seen things."
The professor rolled his eyes.
"Dear, I understand that you're not familiar with the skeptical literature. You may not realize how easy it is for a trained magician to fake the seemingly impossible. Remember how I taught Harry to bend spoons? If it seemed like they could always guess what you were thinking, that's called cold reading."
"It wasn't bending spoons."
"What was it, then?"
Petunia bit her lip.
"I can't just tell you. You'll think I'm..."
She swallowed.
"Listen, Michael. I wasn't always like this."
She gestured at herself as though to indicate her lithe form.
"Lily did this because I begged her. For years, I begged her. Lily had always been prettier than me, and I'd been mean to her because of that, and then she got magic. Can you imagine how I felt? And I begged her to use some of that magic on me so that I could be pretty too. Even if I couldn't have her magic, at least I could be pretty."
Tears were gathering in Petunia's eyes.
"And Lily would tell me no and make up the most ridiculous excuses, like the world would end if she were nice to her sister, or a centaur told her not to. The most ridiculous things. And I hated her for it. And when I had just graduated from university, I was going out with this boy, Vernon Dursley. He was fat, and he was the only boy who would talk to me. And he said he wanted children, and that his first son would be named Dudley. And I thought to myself, what kind of parent names their child Dudley Dursley? It was like I saw my whole future life stretching out in front of me, and I couldn't stand it. And I wrote to my sister and told her that if she didn't help me, I'd rather just...
Petunia stopped.
Anyway,
Petunia said, her voice small.
She gave in. She told me it was dangerous, and I said I didn't care any more, and I drank this potion, and I was sick for weeks. But when I got better, my skin cleared up, and I finally filled out, and I was beautiful. People were nice to me.
Her voice broke.
And after that, I couldn't hate my sister any more, especially when I learned what her magic brought her in the end.
Darling, Michael said gently. You got sick. You gained some weight while resting in bed, and your skin cleared up on its own. Or being sick made you change your diet.
She was a witch,
Petunia repeated.
I saw it.
Petunia,
Michael said. The annoyance was creeping into his voice.
You know that can't be true. Do I really have to explain why?
Petunia wrung her hands. She seemed to be on the verge of tears.
My love, I know I can't win arguments with you, but please, you have to trust me on this. Dad! Mum!
The two of them stopped and looked at Harry as though they'd forgotten there was a third person in the room.
Harry took a deep breath. Mum, your parents didn't have magic, did they?
No,
Petunia said, looking puzzled.
Then no one in your family knew about magic when Lily got her letter. How did they get convinced?
Ah,
Petunia said.
They didn't just send a letter. They sent a professor from Hogwarts. He...
Petunia's eyes flicked to Michael.
He showed us some magic.
Then you don't have to fight over this,
Harry said firmly, hoping against hope that this time, just this once, they would listen to him.
If that's true, we can just get a Hogwarts professor here and see the magic for ourselves, and Dad will admit that it's true. And if not, then Mum will admit that it's false. That's what the experimental method is for, so that we don't have to resolve things just by arguing.
The professor turned and looked down at him, dismissive as usual.
Oh, come now, Harry. Really? Magic? I thought you'd know better than to take this seriously, son, even if you're only 10. Magic is just about the most unscientific thing there is.
Harry's mouth twisted bitterly. He was treated well. Probably better than most genetic fathers treated their own children. Harry had been sent to the best primary schools, and when that didn't work out, he was provided with tutors from the endless pool of starving students. Always Harry had been encouraged to study whatever caught his attention, bought all the books that caught his fancy, sponsored in whatever maths or science competitions he entered. He was given anything reasonable that he wanted, except, maybe, the slightest shred of respect. A doctor teaching biochemistry at Oxford could hardly be expected to listen to the advice of a little boy. You would listen to show interest, of course. That's what a good parent would do, and so, if you conceived of yourself as a good parent, you would do it. But take a 10-year-old seriously. Hardly. Sometimes, Harry wanted to scream at his father.
"Mum," Harry said, "if you want to win this argument with Dad, look in chapter 2 of the first book of the Feynman Lectures on Physics. There's a quote there about how philosophers say a great deal about what science absolutely requires, and it is all wrong, because the only rule in science is that the final arbiter is observation, that you just have to look at the world and report what you see. Off the top of my head, I can't think of where to find something about how it's an ideal of science to settle things by experiment instead of arguments."
His mother looked down at him and smiled.
"Thank you, Harry, but..."
Her head rose back up to stare at her husband.
"I don't want to win an argument with your father. I want my husband to listen to his wife, who loves him, and trust her just this once."
Harry closed his eyes briefly. Hopeless. Both of his parents were just hopeless. Now his parents were getting into one of those arguments again. One where his mother tried to make his father feel guilty, and his father tried to make his mother feel stupid.
"I'm going to my room," Harry announced. His voice trembled a little. "Please try not to fight too much about this, Mum, Dad. We'll know soon enough how it comes out. Right?"
"Of course, Harry," said his father, and his mother gave him a reassuring kiss. And then they went on fighting while Harry climbed the stairs to his bedroom. He shut the door behind him and tried to think. The funny thing was, he should have agreed with Dad. No one had ever seen any evidence of magic, and according to Mum, there was a whole magical world out there. How could anyone keep something like that a secret? More magic? That seemed like a rather suspicious sort of excuse. It should have been a clean case for Mum joking, lying, or being insane, in ascending order of awfulness. If Mum had sent the letter herself, that would explain how it arrived at the letterbox without a stamp. A little insanity was far, far less improbable than the universe really working like that. Except that some part of Harry was utterly convinced that magic was real, and had been since the instant he saw the putative letter from the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. Harry rubbed his forehead, grimacing. "Don't believe everything you think," one of his books had said. But this bizarre certainty, Harry was finding himself just expecting that, yes, a Hogwarts professor would show up and wave a wand and magic would come out. The strange certainty was making no effort to guard itself against falsification, wasn't making excuses in advance for why there wouldn't be a professor, or the professor would only be able to bend spoons.
"Where did you come from, strange little prediction?"
Harry directed the thought at his brain.
"Why do I believe what I believe?"
Usually, Harry was pretty good at answering that question. But in this particular case, he had no clue what his brain was thinking. Harry mentally shrugged. A flat metal plate on a door affords pushing, and a handle on a door affords pulling, and the thing to do with a testable hypothesis is to go and test it. He took a piece of lined paper from his desk and started writing.
"Dear Deputy Headmistress,"
Harry paused, reflecting, then discarded the paper for another, tapping another millimeter of graphite from his mechanical pencil. This called for careful calligraphy.
"Dear Deputy Headmistress Minerva McGonagall, or whomsoever it may concern, I received your letter of acceptance to Hogwarts addressed to Mr. H. Potter. You may not be aware that my genetic parents, James Potter and Lily Potter, formerly Lily Evans, are dead. I was adopted by Lily's sister, Petunia Evans Veris, and her husband, Michael Veris Evans. I am extremely interested in attending Hogwarts, conditional on such a place actually existing. Only my mother Petunia says she knows about magic, and she can't use it herself. My father is highly skeptical. I myself am uncertain. I also don't know where to obtain any of the books or equipment listed in your acceptance letter. Mother mentioned that you sent a Hogwarts representative to Lily Potter, then Lily Evans, in order to demonstrate to her family that magic was real, and, I presume, help Lily obtain her school materials. If you could do this for my own family, it would be extremely helpful. Sincerely, Harry James Potter Evans Veris."
Harry added their current address, then folded up the letter and put it in an envelope, which he addressed to Hogwarts. Further consideration led him to obtain a candle and drip wax onto the flap of the envelope, into which, using a penknife's tip, he impressed the initials H.J.P.E.V. If he was going to descend into this madness, he was going to do it with style. Then he opened his door and went back downstairs. His father was sitting in the living room and reading a book of higher maths to show how smart he was, and his mother was in the kitchen preparing one of his father's favourite meals to show how loving she was. It didn't look like they were talking to one another at all. As scary as arguments could be, not arguing was somehow much worse.
"Mum,"
Harry said into the unnerving silence,
"I'm going to test the hypothesis. According to your theory, how do I send an owl to Hogwarts?"
His mother turned from the kitchen sink to stare at him, looking shocked.
I don't know. I think you just have to own a magic owl."
That should have sounded highly suspicious. "Oh, so there's no way to test your theory, then?" But the peculiar certainty in Harry seemed willing to stick its neck out even further.
"Well, the letter got here somehow," Harry said, "so I'll just wave it around outside and call, 'Letter for Hogwarts,' and see if an owl picks it up. Dad, do you want to come and watch?"
His father shook his head minutely and kept on reading.
Of course,
Harry thought to himself. Magic was a disgraceful thing that only stupid people believed in. If his father went so far as to test the hypothesis, or even watch it being tested, that would feel like associating himself with that. Only as Harry stumped out the back door into the back garden did it occur to him that if an owl did come down and snatch the letter, he was going to have some trouble telling Dad about it.
But, well, that can't really happen, can it? No matter what my brain seems to believe, if an owl really comes down and grabs this envelope, I'm going to have worries a lot more important than what Dad thinks.
Harry took a deep breath and raised the envelope into the air. He swallowed. Calling out, "Letter for Hogwarts," while holding an envelope high in the air in the middle of your own back garden was actually pretty embarrassing, now that he thought about it.
No, I'm better than Dad. I will use the scientific method, even if it makes me feel stupid.
Letter,
Harry said, but it actually came out as more of a whispered croak. Harry steeled his will and shouted into the empty sky.
Letter for Hogwarts! Can I get an owl?
Harry?
Asked a bemused woman's voice, one of the neighbours. Harry pulled down his hand like it was on fire and hid the envelope behind his back like it was drug money. His whole face was hot with shame. An old woman's face peered out from above the neighbouring fence, grizzled grey hair escaping from her hairnet. Mrs. Fig, the occasional babysitter.
What are you doing, Harry?
Nothing,
Harry said in a strangled voice.
Just testing a really silly theory.
Did you get your acceptance letter from Hogwarts?
Harry froze in place.
Yes,
Harry's lips said a little while later.
I got a letter from Hogwarts. They say they want my owl by the 31st of July. But...
But you don't have an owl. Oh, poor dear. I can't imagine what someone must have been thinking, sending you just the standard letter.
A wrinkled arm stretched out over the fence and opened an expectant hand. Hardly even thinking at this point, Harry gave over his envelope.
Oh, just leave it to me, dear,
said Mrs. Fig.
And in a jiffy or two, I'll have someone over.
And her face disappeared from over the fence. There was a long silence in the garden. Then a boy's voice said, calmly and quietly,
What?
Chapter 2. Everything I Believe is False.
Of course it was my fault. There's no one else here who could be responsible for anything. Now, just to be clear,
Harry said,
if the professor does levitate you, Dad, when you know you haven't been attached to any wires, that's going to be sufficient evidence. You're not going to turn around and say that it's a magician's trick. That wouldn't be fair play. If you feel that way, you should say so now, and we can figure out a different experiment instead.
Harry's father, Professor Michael Verus Evans, rolled his eyes.
Yes, Harry.
And you, Mum, your theory says that the professor should be able to do this,
and if that doesn't happen, you'll admit you're mistaken. Nothing about how magic doesn't work when people are skeptical of it or anything like that.
Deputy Headmistress Minerva McGonagall was watching Harry with a bemused expression. She looked quite witchy in her black robes and pointed hat, but when she spoke she sounded formal and Scottish, which didn't go together with the look at all. At first glance she looked like someone who ought to cackle and put babies in cauldrons, but the whole effect was ruined as soon as she opened her mouth.
"Is that sufficient, Mr. Potter?" she said. "Shall I go ahead and demonstrate?"
"Sufficient? Probably not," Harry said. "But at least it will help. Go ahead, Deputy Headmistress."
"Just Professor will do,"
said she, and then...
"Wingardium Leviosa."
Harry looked at his father. Harry said. His father looked back at him. His father echoed. Then Professor Varys Evans looked back at Professor McGonagall.
"All right, you can put me down now."
His father was lowered carefully to the ground. Harry ruffled a hand through his own hair. Maybe it was just that strange part of him which had already been convinced, but...
"That's a bit of an anticlimax,"
Harry said.
"You'd think there'd be some kind of more dramatic mental event associated with updating on an observation of infinitesimal probability."
Harry stopped himself. Mum, the witch, and even his dad were giving him that look again.
"I mean, with finding out that everything I believe is false."
Seriously, it should have been more dramatic. His brain ought to have been flushing its entire current stock of hypotheses about the universe, none of which allowed this to happen. But instead, his brain just seemed to be going, "All right, I saw the Hogwarts professor wave her wand and make your father rise into the air. Now what?" The witch lady was smiling benevolently upon them, looking quite amused.
"Would you like a further demonstration, Mr. Potter?"
"You don't have to," Harry said. "We've performed a definitive experiment. But..."
Harry hesitated. He couldn't help himself. Actually, under the circumstances, he shouldn't be helping himself. It was right and proper to be curious.
"What else can you do?"
Professor McGonagall turned into a cat. Harry scrambled back unthinkingly, backpedaling so fast that he tripped over a stray stack of books and landed hard on his bottom with a thwack. His hands came down to catch himself without quite reaching properly, and there was a warning twinge in his shoulder as the weight came down unbraced. At once, the small tabby cat morphed back up into a robed woman.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Potter,"
said the witch, sounding sincere, though the corners of her lips were twitching upwards.
"I should have warned you."
Harry was breathing in short gasps. His voice came out choked.
"You can't do that!"
"It's only a transfiguration,"
said Professor McGonagall.
"In an Omega's transformation, to be exact."
"You turned into a cat! A small cat! You violated conservation of energy! That's not just an arbitrary rule, it's implied by the form of the quantum Hamiltonian! Rejecting it destroys unitarity, and then you get FTL signalling! And cats are complicated!
A human mind can't just visualize a whole cat's anatomy and all the cat biochemistry. What about neurology? How can you go on thinking using a cat-sized brain?
Professor McGonagall's lips were twitching harder now.
Magic?
Magic isn't enough to do that. You'd have to be a god.
Professor McGonagall blinked.
If it's the first time I've ever been called that.
A blur was coming over Harry's vision as his brain started to comprehend what had just broken. The whole idea of a unified universe with mathematical, regular laws, that was what had been flushed down the toilet. The whole notion of physics. 3,000 years of resolving big, complicated things into smaller pieces, discovering that the music of the planets was the same tune as a falling apple, finding that the true laws were perfectly universal and had no exceptions anywhere and took the form of simple maths governing the smallest parts. Not to mention that the mind was the brain, and the brain was made of neurons, and a brain was what a person was. And then...
a woman turned into a cat. So much for all that. 100 questions fought for priority over Harry's lips, and the winner poured out.
And what kind of incantation is Wingardium Leviosa? Who invents the words to these spells? Nursery schoolers?
That will do, Mr. Potter,
Professor McGonagall said crisply, though her eyes shone with suppressed amusement.
If you wish to learn about magic, I suggest that we finalize the paperwork so that you can go to Hogwarts.
Right,
Harry said, somewhat dazed. He pulled his thoughts together. The March of Reason would just have to start over. That was all. They still had the experimental method, and that was the important thing.
How do I get to Hogwarts, then?
A choked laugh escaped Professor McGonagall, as if extracted from her by tweezers.
Hold on a moment, Harry, his father said. Remember why you haven't been going to school up until now? What about your condition?
Professor McGonagall spun to face Michael.
His condition? What's this?
I don't sleep right, Harry said. He waved his hands helplessly. My sleep cycle is 26 hours long. I always go to sleep 2 hours later every day. I can't fall asleep any earlier than that, and then the next day I go to sleep 2 hours later than that. 10 p.m., 12 a.m., 2 a.m., 4 a.m., until it goes around the clock. Even if I try to wake up early, it makes no difference, and I'm a wreck that whole day. That's why I haven't been going to a normal school up until now.
One of the reasons,
said his mother. Harry shot her a glare. McGonagall gave a long,
I can't recall hearing about such a condition before,
she said slowly.
I'll check with Madame Pomfrey to see if she knows any remedies.
Then her face brightened.
No, I'm sure this won't be a problem. I'll find a solution in time. No.
And her gaze sharpened again.
What are these other reasons?
Harry sent his parents a glare.
I am a conscientious objector to child conscription, on the grounds that I should not have to suffer for a disintegrating school system's failure to provide teachers or study materials of even minimally adequate quality.
Both of Harry's parents howled with laughter at that, like they thought it was all a big joke.
"Ho, ho, ho," said Harry's father, eyes bright. "Is that why you bit a maths teacher in third year?"
"She didn't know what a logarithm was."
"Of course," seconded Harry's mother. "Biting her was a very mature response to that."
Harry's father nodded.
"A well-considered policy for addressing the problem of teachers who don't understand logarithms."
"I was 7 years old. How long are you going to keep on bringing that up?"
"I know," said his mother sympathetically. "You bite one maths teacher, and they never let you forget it, do they?"
Harry turned to Professor McGonagall.
"There! You see what I have to deal with."
"Excuse me,"
said Petunia, and fled through the back door into the garden, from which her screams of laughter were clearly audible.
There...
Professor McGonagall seemed to be having trouble speaking for some reason.
"There is to be no biting of teachers at Hogwarts. Is that quite clear, Mr. Potter?"
Harry scowled at her.
"Fine. I won't bite anyone who doesn't bite me first."
Professor Michael Verus Evans also had to leave the room briefly upon hearing that.
"Well,"
Professor McGonagall sighed after Harry's parents had composed themselves and returned.
"Well, I think, under the circumstances, that I should avoid taking you to purchase your study materials until a day or two before school begins."
"What? Why? The other children already know magic, don't they? I have to start catching up right away."
"Rest assured, Mr. Potter, Hogwarts is quite capable of teaching the basics, and I suspect, Mr. Potter, that if I leave you alone for 2 months with your schoolbooks, even without a wand, I will return to this house only to find a crater billowing purple smoke, a depopulated city surrounding it, and a plague of flaming zebras terrorizing what remains of England."
Harry's mother and father nodded in perfect unison.
"Mum! Dad!"
Chapter 3. Comparing Reality to Its Alternatives.
"But then the question is, who?"
"Good Lord," said the barman, peering at Harry. "Is this? Can this be?"
Harry leaned towards the bar of the leaky cauldron as best he could, though it came up to somewhere around the tips of his eyebrows. A question like that deserved his very best.
"Am I? Could I be? Maybe. You never know. If I'm not... But then the question is, who?"
"Bless my soul," whispered the old barman. "Harry Potter! What an honour!"
Harry blinked, then rallied.
"Well, yes. You're quite perceptive. Most people don't realise that so quickly."
"That's enough,"
Professor McGonagall said. Her hand tightened on Harry's shoulder.
"Don't pester the boy, Tom. He's quite new to all this."
"But it is him,"
quavered an old woman.
"It's Harry Potter."
With a scraping sound, she got up from her chair.
"Doris,"
McGonagall said warningly. The glare she shot around the room should have been enough to intimidate anyone.
"I only want to shake his hand,"
the woman whispered. She bent low and stuck out a wrinkled hand, which Harry,
feeling confused and more uncomfortable than he ever had in his life, carefully shook. Tears fell from the woman's eyes onto her clasped hands.
"My grandson was an aura,"
she whispered to him.
"Died in 79. Thank you, Harry Potter. Thank heavens for you."
"You're welcome,"
Harry said automatically, and then he turned his head and shot Professor McGonagall a frightened, pleading look. Professor McGonagall slammed her foot down just as the general rush was about to start. It made a noise that gave Harry a new referent for the phrase, "crack of doom," and everyone froze in place.
"We're in a hurry,"
Professor McGonagall said in a voice that sounded perfectly, utterly normal. They left the bar without any trouble.
"Professor,"
Harry said once they were in the courtyard. He had meant to ask what was going on, but oddly found himself asking an entirely different question instead.
"Who was that pale man by the corner? The man with the twitching eye?"
"Hmm?"
said Professor McGonagall, sounding a bit surprised. Perhaps she hadn't expected that question either.
"That was Professor Quirinius Quirrell. He'll be teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts this year at Hogwarts."
"I had the strangest feeling that I knew him,"
Harry rubbed his forehead,
"and that I shouldn't ought to shake his hand."
Like meeting someone who had been a friend, once, before something went drastically wrong. That wasn't really it at all, but Harry couldn't find words.
"And what was all of that?"
Professor McGonagall was giving him an odd glance.
"Mr. Potter, do you know how much have you been told about how your parents died?"
Harry returned a steady look.
"My parents are alive and well, and they always refuse to talk about how my genetic parents died, from which I infer that it wasn't good."
"An admirable loyalty,"
said Professor McGonagall. Her voice went low.
"Though it hurts to hear you say it like that, Lily and James were friends of mine."
Harry looked away, suddenly ashamed.
"I'm sorry,"
he said in a small voice.
"But I have a mum and dad, and I know that I'd just make myself unhappy by comparing that reality to something perfect that I built up in my imagination."
"That is amazingly wise of you,"
Professor McGonagall said quietly.
"But your genetic parents died very well indeed, protecting you."
"Protecting me?"
Something strange clutched at Harry's heart.
"What did happen?"
Professor McGonagall sighed. Her wand tapped Harry's forehead, and his vision blurred for a moment.
"Something of a disguise,"
she said,
"so that this doesn't happen again. Not until you're ready."
Then her wand licked out again and tapped three times on a brick wall, which hollowed into a hole and dilated and expanded and shivered into a huge archway, revealing a long row of shops with signs advertising cauldrons and dragon livers. Harry didn't blink. It wasn't like anyone was turning into a cat. And they walked forwards, together, into the wizarding world. There were merchants hawking bounce boots,
"Made with real flubber,"
and
"Knives, +3, forks, +2, spoons with a +4 bonus.
There were goggles that would turn anything you looked at green, and a line-up of comfy armchairs with ejection seats for emergencies. Harry's head kept rotating, rotating like it was trying to wind itself off his neck. It was like walking through the magical items section of an advanced Dungeons and Dragons rulebook. He didn't play the game, but he did enjoy reading the rulebooks. Harry desperately didn't want to miss a single item for sale, in case it was one of the three you needed to complete the cycle of infinite wish spells. Then Harry spotted something that made him, entirely without thinking, veer off from the deputy headmistress and start heading straight into the shop, a front of blue bricks with bronze metal trim. He was brought back to reality only when Professor McGonagall stepped right in front of him.
"Mr. Potter,"
she said. Harry blinked, then realized what he'd just done.
"I'm sorry. I forgot for a moment that I was with you instead of my family."
Harry gestured at the shop window, which displayed fiery letters that shone piercingly bright and yet remote, spelling out, "Bigbum's Brilliant Books."
"When you walk past a bookshop you haven't visited before, you have to go in and look around. That's the family rule."
"That is the most Ravenclaw thing I have ever heard."
"What?"
"Nothing. Mr. Potter, our first step is to visit Gringotts, the bank of the Wizarding World. Your genetic family vault is there, with the inheritance your genetic parents left you, and you'll need money for school supplies."
She sighed.
"And I suppose a certain amount of spending money for books could be excused as well, though you might want to hold off for a time. Hogwarts has quite a large library on magical subjects, and the tower in which I strongly suspect you'll be living has a more broad-ranging library of its own. Any book you bought new would probably be a duplicate."
Harry nodded, and they walked on.
"Don't get me wrong, it's a great distraction,"
Harry said as his head kept swivelling.
"Probably the best distraction anyone has ever tried on me. But don't think I've forgotten about our pending discussion."
Professor McGonagall sighed.
"Your parents, or your mother at any rate, may have been very wise not to tell you."
"So, you wish that I could continue in blissful ignorance? There is a certain flaw in that plan, Professor McGonagall."
"I suppose it would be rather pointless,"
the witch said tightly,
"when anyone on the street could tell you the story. Very well."
And she told him of He Who Must Not Be Named, the Dark Lord Voldemort.
"Voldemort?"
Harry whispered. It should have been funny, but it wasn't. The name burned with a cold feeling, ruthlessness, diamond clarity. A hammer of pure titanium descending upon an anvil of yielding flesh. A chill swept over Harry, even as he pronounced the word, and he resolved, then and there, to use safer terms like you-know-who. The Dark Lord had raged upon Wizarding Britain like a wilding wolf, tearing and rending at the fabric of their everyday lives. Other countries had wrung their hands but hesitated to intervene, whether out of apathetic selfishness or simple fear, for whichever was first among them to oppose the Dark Lord, their peace would be the next target of his terror.
The bystander effect, thought Harry, thinking of Latane and Darley's experiment, which had shown that you were more likely to get help if you had an epileptic fit in front of one person than in front of three.
Diffusion of responsibility. Everyone hoping that someone else would go first.
The Death Eaters had followed in the Dark Lord's wake, and in his vanguard, carrion vultures to pick at wounds, or snakes to bite and weaken. The Death Eaters were not as terrible as the Dark Lord, but they were terrible, and they were many. And the Death Eaters wielded more than wands. There was wealth within those masked ranks, and political power, and secrets held in blackmail to paralyze a society trying to protect itself. An old and respected journalist, Yermy Wibble, called for increased taxes and conscription. He shouted that it was absurd for the many to cower in fear of the few. His skin, only his skin, had been found nailed to the newsroom wall that next morning, next to the skins of his wife and two daughters. Everyone wished for something more to be done, and no one dared to take the lead to propose it. Whoever stood out the most became the next example. Until the names of James and Lily Potter rose to the top of that list. And those two might have died with their wands in their hands and not regretted their choices, for they were heroes. But for that they had an infant child. Their son, Harry Potter. Tears were coming into Harry's eyes. He wiped them away in anger, or maybe desperation.
I didn't know these people. Not really. They aren't my parents now. It would be pointless to feel sad for them.
When Harry was done sobbing into the witch's robes, he looked up and felt a little bit better to see tears in Professor McGonagall's eyes as well.
So, what happened?
Harry said, his voice trembling.
The Dark Lord came to Godric's Hollow,
Professor McGonagall said in a whisper.
You should have been hidden, but you were betrayed. The Dark Lord killed James, and he killed Lily, and he came in the end to you, to your cot. He cast the killing curse at you, and that was where it ended. The killing curse is formed of pure hate and strikes directly at the soul, severing it from the body. It cannot be blocked, and whomever it strikes, they die. But you survived. You're the only person to ever survive. The killing curse rebounded and struck the Dark Lord, leaving only the burnt hulk of his body and a scar upon your forehead. That was the end of the terror, and we were free. That, Harry Potter, is why people want to see the scar on your forehead, and why they want to shake your hand.
The storm of weeping that had washed through Harry had used up all his tears. He could not cry again. He was done. And somewhere, in the back of his mind, was a small, small note of confusion. A sense of something wrong about that story. And it should have been part of Harry's art to notice that tiny note. But he was distracted. For it is a sad rule that whenever you are most in need of your art as a rationalist, that is when you are most likely to forget it. Harry detached himself from Professor McGonagall's side.
Have to think about this,
he said, trying to keep his voice under control. He stared at his shoes.
You can go ahead and call them my parents if you want. You don't have to say genetic parents or anything. I guess there's no reason I can't have two mothers and two fathers.
There was no sound from Professor McGonagall, and they walked together in silence, until they came before a great white building, with vast bronze doors, and carven words above saying, Gringotts Bank.
Chapter 4. The Efficient Market Hypothesis.
World domination is such an ugly phrase. I prefer to call it world optimization.
Heaps of gold galleons, stacks of silver sickles, piles of bronze knuts. Harry stood there and stared with his mouth open at the family vault. He had so many questions he didn't know where to start. From just outside the door of the vault, Professor McGonagall watched him, seeming to lean casually against the wall, but with eyes intent. Well, that made sense. Being plopped in front of a giant heap of gold coins was a test of character, so pure it was archetypal.
"Are these coins the pure metal?"
Harry said finally.
"What?"
hissed the goblin Griphook, who was waiting near the door.
"Are you questioning the integrity of Gringotts, Mr. Potter Evans Verus?"
"No," said Harry absently. "Not at all. Sorry if that came out wrong, sir. I just have no idea at all how your financial system works. I'm asking if galleons in general are made of pure gold."
"Of course," said Griphook.
"And can anyone coin them, or are they issued by a monopoly that thereby collects seniorage?"
"What?" said Professor McGonagall. Griphook grinned, showing sharp teeth.
"Only a fool would trust any but goblin coin."
"In other words," Harry said, "the coins aren't supposed to be worth any more than the metal making them up."
Griphook stared at Harry. Professor McGonagall looked bemused.
"I mean, suppose I came in here with a ton of silver. Could I get a ton of sickles made from it?"
"For a fee, Mr. Potter Evans Verus."
The goblin watched him with glittering eyes.
"For a certain fee, where would you find a ton of silver, I wonder?"
"I was speaking hypothetically,"
Harry said.
"For now, at any rate. So, how much would you charge in fees, as a fraction of the whole weight?"
Griphook's eyes were intent.
"I would have to consult my superiors."
"Give me a wild guess. I won't hold Gringotts to it."
"A 20th part of the metal would well pay for the coining."
Harry nodded.
"Thank you very much, Mr. Griphook. So, not only is the wizarding economy almost completely decoupled from the muggle economy, no one here has ever heard of arbitrage."
The larger muggle economy had a fluctuating trade range of gold to silver,
So, every time the Muggle gold-to-silver ratio got more than 5% away from the weight of 17 sickles to 1 galleon, either gold or silver should have drained from the wizarding economy until it became impossible to maintain the exchange rate. Bring in a ton of silver, change to sickles, and pay 5%, change the sickles for galleons, take the gold to the Muggle world, exchange it for more silver than you started with, and repeat. Wasn't the Muggle gold-to-silver ratio somewhere around 50 to 1? Harry didn't think it was 17, anyway. And it looked like the silver coins were actually smaller than the gold ones. Then again, Harry was standing in a bank that literally stored your money in vaults full of gold coins guarded by dragons, where you had to go in and take coins out of your vault whenever you wanted to spend money. The finer points of arbitraging away market inefficiencies might well be lost on them. He'd been tempted to make snide remarks about the crudity of their financial system.
But the sad thing is, their way is probably better.
On the other hand, one competent hedge fundee could probably own the whole wizarding world within a week. Harry filed away this notion in case he ever ran out of money, or had a week free. Meanwhile, the giant heaps of gold coins within the Potter vault ought to suit his near-term requirements. Harry stumped forward and began picking up gold coins with one hand and dumping them into the other. When he had reached 20, Professor McGonagall coughed.
"I think that'll be more than enough to pay for your school supplies, Mr. Potter."
Harry said, his mind elsewhere.
"Hold on, I'm doing a Fermi calculation."
"A what?"
said Professor McGonagall, sounding somewhat alarmed.
"It's a mathematical thing, named after Enrico Fermi. A way of getting rough numbers quickly in your head."
20 gold galleons weighed a tenth of a kilogram, maybe? And gold was, what, 10,000 British pounds a kilogram? So, a galleon would be worth about £50. The mounds of gold coins looked to be about 60 coins high and 20 coins wide in either dimension of the base, and a mound was pyramidal, so it would be around one-third of the cube. 8,000 galleons per mound, roughly, and there were around 5 mounds of that size, so 40,000 galleons, or 2 million pounds sterling. Not bad. Harry smiled with a certain grim satisfaction. It was too bad that he was right in the middle of discovering the amazing new world of magic and couldn't take time out to explore the amazing new world of being rich, which a quick Fermi estimate said was roughly a billion times less interesting.
"Still, that's the last time I ever mow a lawn for one lousy pound."
Harry wheeled from the giant heap of money.
"Pardon me for asking, Professor McGonagall, but I understand that my parents were in their 20s when they died. Is this a usual amount of money for a young couple to have in their vault, in the wizarding world?"
If it was, a cup of tea probably cost £5,000. Rule one of economics. You can't eat money. Professor McGonagall shook her head.
"Your father was the last heir of an old family, Mr. Potter. It is also possible..."
The witch hesitated.
"Some of this money may be from bounties placed on you-know-who, payable to his to whoever might defeat him, or whose bounties might not have been collected yet. I'm not sure."
"Interesting,"
Harry said slowly.
So, some of this really is, in a sense, mine. That is, earned by me. Sort of. Possibly. Even if I don't remember the occasion.
Harry's fingers tapped against his trouser leg.
That makes me feel less guilty about spending a very tiny fraction of it. Don't panic, Professor McGonagall.
Mr. Potter, you are a minor, and as such, you will only be allowed to make reasonable withdrawals from...
I am all about reasonable. I'm totally on board with fiscal prudence and impulse control. But I did see some things on the way here which would constitute sensible, grown-up purchases.
Harry locked gazes with Professor McGonagall, engaging in a silent staring contest.
Like what?
Professor McGonagall said finally.
Trunks whose insides hold more than their outsides.
Professor McGonagall's face grew stern.
Those are very expensive, Mr. Potter.
Yes, but,
Harry pleaded,
I'm sure that when I'm an adult I'll want one, and I can afford one. Logically, it would make just as much sense to buy it now instead of later, and get the use of it right away. It's the same money either way, right? I mean, I would want a good one, with lots of room inside, good enough that I wouldn't have to just get a better one later.
Harry trailed off hopefully. Professor McGonagall's gaze didn't waver.
And just what would you keep in a trunk like that, Mr. Potter?
Books.
Of course,
sighed Professor McGonagall.
You should have told me much earlier that sort of magic item existed, and that I could afford one. Now my father and I are going to have to spend the next 2 days frantically hitting up all the second-hand bookshops for old textbooks, so I can have a decent science library with me at Hogwarts. And maybe a small science fiction collection, if I can assemble something decent out of the bargain bins. Or, better yet, I'll make the deal a little sweeter for you, okay? Just let me buy...
Mr. Potter, you think you can bribe me?
What? No, not like that. I'm saying... Hogwarts can keep some of the books I bring, if you think that any of them would make good additions to the library. I'm going to be getting them cheap, and I just want to have them around somewhere or other. It's okay to bribe people with books, right? That's a...
family tradition.
Yes, exactly.
Professor McGonagall's body seemed to slump, the shoulders lowering within her black robes.
I cannot deny the sense of your words, though I much wish I could. I will allow you to withdraw an additional 100 galleons, Mr. Potter.
She sighed again.
I know that I shall regret this, and I'm doing it anyway.
That's the spirit. And does a moakskin pouch do what I think it does?
It can't do as much as a trunk,
the witch said with visible reluctance.
But a moakskin pouch with a retrieval charm and undetectable extension charm can hold a number of items until they are called forth by the one who emplaced them.
Yes, I definitely need one of those, too. it would be like the super belt pack of ultimate awesomeness. Batman's utility belt of holding. Never mind my Swiss Army knife, I could carry a whole tool set in there. Or books. I could have the top three books I was reading on me at all times, and just pull one out anywhere. I'll never have to waste another minute of my life. What do you say, Professor McGonagall? It's for the sake of children's reading, the best of all possible causes.
I suppose you may add another 10 galleons.
Griphook was favouring Harry with a gaze of frank respect, possibly even outright admiration.
And a little spending money, like you mentioned earlier. I think I can remember seeing one or two other things I might want to store in that pouch.
Don't push it, Mr. Potter!
But, oh, Professor McGonagall, why rain on my parade? Surely this is a happy day when I discover all things wizarding for the first time. Why act the part of the grumpy grown-up when instead you could smile and remember your own innocent childhood, watching the look of delight upon my young face as I buy a few toys, using an insignificant fraction of the wealth that I earned by defeating the most terrible wizard Britain has ever known. Not that I'm accusing you of being ungrateful or anything, but still, what are a few toys compared to that?
Phew!
Growled Professor McGonagall. There was a look on her face so fearsome and terrible that Harry squeaked and stepped back, knocking over a pile of gold coins with a great jingling noise and sprawling backwards into a heap of money. Griphook sighed and put a palm over his face.
"He would be doing a great service to Wizarding Britain, Mr. Potter, if I locked you in this vault and left you here."
And they left without any more trouble. Chapter 5. The Fundamental Attribution Error.
It would have required a supernatural intervention for him to have your morality given his environment.
The Moke Shop was a quaint little shop. Some might even say cute, ensconced behind a vegetable stall that was behind a magical glove shop that was on an alleyway off a side street of Diagon Alley. Disappointingly, the shopkeeper was not a wizened ancient crone, just a nervous-looking young woman wearing faded yellow robes. Right now, she was holding out a Moke Super Pouch QX31, whose selling point was that it had a widening lip as well as an undetectable extension charm. You could actually fit big things in it, though the total volume was still limited. Harry had insisted on coming here straight away. First thing, insisted as hard as he thought he could without making Professor McGonagall suspicious. Harry had something he needed to put into the pouch as soon as possible. It wasn't the bag of galleons that Professor McGonagall had allowed him to withdraw from Gringotts. It was all the other galleons that Harry had surreptitiously shoved into his pocket after falling into a heap of gold coins. That had been a real accident, but Harry was never one to discard an opportunity. Though it had really been more of a spur-of-the-moment thing. Ever since, Harry had been awkwardly carrying the allowed bag of galleons next to his trouser pocket, so that any jingling would seem to come from the right place. This still left the question of how he was actually going to get the other coins into the pouch without getting caught. The golden coins might have been his, but they were still stolen. Self-stolen? Auto-thieved. Harry looked up from the Moak super pouch QX31 on the counter in front of him.
Can I try this for a bit, to make sure it works, reliably?
He widened his eyes, an expression of boyish, playful innocence. Sure enough, after 10 repetitions of putting the coin bag into the pouch, reaching in, whispering,
"Bag of gold!"
and taking it out, Professor McGonagall took a step away and began examining some of the other items in the shop, and the shopkeeper turned her head to watch. Harry dropped the bag of gold into the moakskin pouch with his left hand. His right hand came out of his pocket, tightly holding some of the gold coins. Reached into the moakskin pouch, dropped the loose galleons and, with a whisper of,
"Bag of gold!"
retrieved the original bag. Then the bag went back into his left hand to be dropped again, and Harry's right hand went back into his pocket. Professor McGonagall looked back at him once, but Harry managed to avoid freezing or flinching, and she didn't seem to notice anything. Though you never did quite know, with the adults that had a sense of humour. It took 3 iterations to get the job done, and Harry guessed he'd managed to steal maybe 30 galleons from himself. Harry reached up, wiped a bit of sweat from his forehead, and exhaled.
"I'd like this one, please."
15 galleons lighter, twice the price of a wizard's wand, apparently, and 1 Moak Super Pouch QX31 heavier, Harry and Professor McGonagall pushed their way out of the door. The door formed a hand and waved goodbye to them as they left, extruding its arm in a way that made Harry feel a bit queasy. And then, unfortunately...
"Are you really Harry Potter?"
whispered the old man, one huge tear sliding down his cheek.
"You wouldn't lie about it, would you? Only I'd heard rumours that you didn't really survive the killing curse, and that's why no one ever heard from you again."
It seemed that Professor McGonagall's disguise spell was less than perfectly effective against more experienced magical practitioners. Professor McGonagall had laid a hand on Harry's shoulder and yanked him into the nearest alleyway the moment she'd heard,
"Harry Potter!"
The old man had followed, but at least it looked like no one else had heard. Harry considered the question. Was he really Harry Potter?
"I only know what other people have told me," Harry said. "It's not like I remember being born."
His hand brushed his forehead.
"I've had this scar as long as I remember, and I've been told my name was Harry Potter as long as I remember. But..."
Harry said thoughtfully,
"if there's already sufficient cause to postulate a conspiracy, there's no reason why they wouldn't just find another orphan and raise him to believe that he was Harry Potter."
Professor McGonagall drew her hand over her face in exasperation.
"You look just about exactly like your father, James, the year he first attended Hogwarts. And I can attest on the basis of personality alone that you are related to the Scourge of Gryffindor."
"She could be in on it too," Harry observed.
"No,"
quavered the old man.
"She's right. You have your mother's eyes."
Harry frowned.
"I suppose you could be in on it, too."
"Enough, Mr. Potter!"
The old man raised up a hand as if to touch Harry, but then let it fall.
"I'm just glad that you're alive," he murmured. "Thank you, Harry Potter. Thank you for what you did. I'll leave you alone now."
And his cane slowly tapped away, out the alley and down the main street of Diagon Alley. The professor looked around, her expression tense and grim. Harry automatically looked around himself, but the alley seemed empty of all but old leaves, and from the mouth leading out into Diagon Alley, only swift striding passerbys could be seen. Finally, Professor McGonagall seemed to relax.
"That was not well done,"
she said in a low voice.
"I know you're not used to this, Mr. Potter, but people do care about you. Please be kind to them."
Harry looked down at his shoes.
"They shouldn't," he said with a tinge of bitterness. "Care about me, I mean."
"You saved them from you know who,"
said Professor McGonagall.
"How should they not care?"
Harry looked up at the witch lady's strict expression beneath her pointed hat and sighed.
"I suppose there's no chance that if I said fundamental attribution error, you'd have any idea what that meant."
"No,"
said the professor in her precise Scottish accent.
"But please explain, Mr. Potter, if you'd be so kind."
"Well,"
Harry said, trying to figure out how to describe that particular bit of Muggle science.
"Suppose you come into work and see your colleague kicking his desk. You think, what an angry person he must be. Your colleague is thinking about how someone bumped him into a wall on the way to work and then shouted at him. Anyone would be angry at that, he thinks. When we look at others, we see personality traits that explain their behaviour. But when we look at ourselves, we see circumstances that explain our behaviour. People's stories make internal sense to them from the inside, but we don't see people's histories trailing behind them in the air. We only see them in one situation, and we don't see what they would be like in a different situation. So, the fundamental attribution error is that we explain by permanent, enduring traits what would be better explained by circumstance and context."
There were some elegant experiments which confirmed this, but Harry wasn't about to go into them. The witch's eyebrows drew up beneath her hat's brim.
"I think I understand," Professor McGonagall said slowly. "But what does this have to do with you?"
Harry kicked the brick wall of the alley hard enough to make his foot hurt.
"People think that I saved them from you-know-who because I'm some kind of great warrior of the light."
"The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord,"
murmured the witch, a strange irony leavening her voice.
"Yes,"
Harry said, annoyance and frustration warring in him.
"Like, I destroyed the Dark Lord because I have some kind of permanent, enduring, destroy the Dark Lord trait. I was 15 months old at the time. I don't know what happened, but I would suppose it had something to do with, as the saying goes, contingent environmental circumstances. and certainly nothing to do with my personality. People don't care about me. They aren't even paying attention to me. They want to shake hands with a bad explanation.
Harry paused and looked at McGonagall.
Do you know what really happened?
I have formed an idea,
said Professor McGonagall.
Of the meeting you, that is.
Yes?
You triumphed over the Dark Lord by being more awful than he was, and survived the killing curse by being more terrible than death.
Ha ha ha!
Harry kicked the wall again. Professor McGonagall chuckled.
Let's get you to Madame Malkin's next. I fear your muggle clothing may be attracting attention.
They ran into two more well-wishers along the way. Madame Malkin's robes had a genuinely boring shopfront. Red, ordinary brick and glass windows showing plain black robes within. Not robes that shone or changed or spun or radiated strange rays that seemed to go right through your shirt and tickle you. Just plain black robes. That was all you could see through the window. The door was propped wide open as if to advertise that there were no secrets here and nothing to hide.
I'm going off for a few minutes while you get fitted for your robes, said Professor McGonagall. Will you be all right with that, Mr. Potter?
Harry nodded. He hated clothes shopping with a fiery passion and couldn't blame the older witch for feeling the same way. Professor McGonagall's wand came out of her sleeve and tapped Harry's head lightly.
And as you'll need to be clear to Madame Malkin's senses, I am removing the obfuscation.
Harry said. That did worry him a little. He still wasn't used to the whole Harry Potter thing.
He went to Hogwarts with Madame Malkin,
McGonagall said.
Even then, she was one of the most composed people I knew. She wouldn't turn a hair if you-know-who himself walked into her shop.
McGonagall's voice was reminiscent and very approving.
Madame Malkin won't bother you, and she won't let anyone else bother you.
Where are you going? Harry inquired. Just in case, you know, something does happen.
McGonagall gave Harry a hard look.
I'm going there,
she said, pointing at a building across the street which showed a sign of a wooden keg.
And buying a drink, which I desperately need. You are to get fitted for your robes. Nothing else. I'll come back to check up on you shortly. And I expect to find Madame Malkin's shop still standing, and not in any way on fire.
Madame Malkin was a bustling old woman, who didn't say a word about Harry when she saw the scar on his forehead, and she shot a sharp look at an assistant when that girl seemed about to say something. Madame Malkin got out a set of animated, writhing bits of cloth that seemed to serve as tape measures, and set to work examining the medium of her art. Next to Harry, a pale young boy with a pointed face and awesome, cool, blonde-white hair seemed to be going through the final stages of a similar process. One of Malkin's two assistants was examining the white-haired boy and the checkerboard gridded robe he was wearing. Occasionally she would tap a corner of the robe with her wand, and the robe would loosen or tighten.
"Hello," said the boy. "Hogwarts, too?"
Harry could predict where this conversation was about to go, and he decided, in a split second of frustration, that enough was enough.
"Good heavens," whispered Harry. "It couldn't be."
He let his eyes widen.
"Your name, sir?"
Draco Malfoy?
Said Draco Malfoy, looking slightly puzzled.
It is you, Draco Malfoy. I never thought I'd be so honoured, sir.
Harry wished he could make tears come out of his eyes. The others usually started crying at around this point.
Oh?
Said Draco, sounding a little confused. Then his lips stretched in a smug smile.
It's good to meet someone who knows his place.
One of the assistants, the one who seemed to recognize Harry, made a muffled choking sound. Harry burbled on.
I'm delighted to meet you, Mr. Malfoy. Just unutterably delighted. And to be attending Hogwarts in your very year. It makes my heart swoon.
Oops. That last part might have sounded a little odd, like he was flirting with Draco or something.
And I am pleased to learn that I shall be treated with respect due to the family of Malfoy.
The other boy lobbed back, accompanied by a smile such as the highest of kings might bestow upon the least of his subjects, if that subject were honest, though poor.
Yeah, damn.
Harry was having trouble thinking up his next line. Well, everyone did want to shake the hand of Harry Potter, so...
When my clothes are fitted, sir, might you deign to shake my hand? I should wish nothing more than to put the capper upon this day. Nay, this month. Indeed, my whole lifetime.
The white blonde-haired boy glared in return.
And what have you done for the Malfoys that entitles you to such a favour? Oh, I am so totally trying this routine on the next person who wants to shake my hand.
Harry bowed his head.